Good Wednesday, everybody. Welcome to another installment of the Cyclone Fanatic podcast, of course, here at CycloneFanatic.com. Special treat for you today. We're changing the game just a little bit. Now, I want to welcome back a friend of mine, Steve Dace. I want to welcome to the program. And Steve, I didn't even know what sports talk radio was before I met you back in 2004. I grew up in Southwest Iowa.
Way back in 2004.
Yeah. We didn't have that where I was from. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of just taken off, and you kind of introduced me to all of that, and it's cool to have you coming on my turf now. I've been on so many of your shows over the years, and welcome to the podcast. It's good to have you here.
I'm looking forward to the conversation, and I think it's really neat to see the business that you guys have built here at Cyclone Fanatic, the success you've had. And I told you from the very beginning that I thought you had a future and a career in this. So I'm really happy for you and the success you guys are having here. It's a phenomenal product you put out.
We appreciate it. And we're looking forward now to having you on board for some podcasts for the rest of the college football season. I like your takes on the game. I mean, even if I disagree with them, which I do a lot, they entertain me, though.
And I sometimes disagree with myself week to week.
I think that that's what it's all about, though, especially on Cy-Hawk week. I know that this is a week where you can bring a little more perspective to it than even I can. I focused a lot this week on just the changing of the rivalry over the years, and I think it's fascinating that Paul Rhodes is going to bring his team out there in front of a packed student section. And I asked, it really resonated with me when I was talking with Jeff Woody earlier this week, and he was telling me about his childhood, what he remembered from the rivalry. He remembered it being even. He didn't remember the years where, you know, Hayden would
right.
run up the score, you know, trying to impress in-state recruits and trying to squash Iowa State. That's the rivalry that I remembered growing up. And you were on the battlefront, man, for a long time on KXNO in the heart of this rivalry when McCartney was really bringing it back to actually being a rivalry. I'm curious, though, from your perspective, how much has this thing changed, you know, since you kind of started doing your thing in Des Moines?
It's changed a lot, and this was, every year, the most fun week to do the show. And when I first broke into sports talk radio, I was born here, but I grew up in Michigan. And when you spend your teenage years around a group of teams, that's where you build your bond. Mm-hmm. And so I get on sports talk radio here in Iowa, and I don't really have any kind of bond to either Iowa or Iowa State, except for the fact I can't stand Iowa. Mm-hmm. Because for me growing up, in my era, as a Michigan fan as a kid, Michigan and Ohio State weren't the big two in the Big Ten. Michigan and Iowa were in the 80s. And so Iowa was our really big game. So I detested Iowa. So there was a natural affinity there towards Iowa State.
Welcome to CycloneFanatic.com.
And, you know, just my first taste of the rivalry, ironically, happened, Chris, in Michigan Stadium. September of 1998, I'm sitting in Michigan Stadium watching Donovan McNabb run around, through, and over Michigan's defense. And it's like 38-7 at halftime. And they're giving the halftime scores. It's 100 degrees. The wife and I are debating whether to stick around and go home and beat the crowd. And they're giving all the halftime scores around the country. And they give the score. I think it was 38. Iowa State 38, Iowa 9. That was the streak breaker in 1998. Yep. And that was the loudest gasp I heard the whole day from 100,000 people. Even there, people are like, wait, Iowa State's not supposed to beat Iowa.
Yeah.
So that was, ironically, the first taste I had of the rivalry. And then when I had my chance to break into sports talk radio here locally, I realized I've got to emotionally invest myself in what my audience is emotionally invested in. Otherwise, we're probably not going to last really long. So I thought, hey, let's cover, nobody goes to media days and does live shows. So we did it with both schools. Nobody treats both schools. At that time, nobody did. The idea that the Iowa City Press Citizen or the Cedar Rapids Gazette was going to send somebody to Iowa State Media Day was laughed at. Didn't happen.
Yeah.
I remember when I contacted Iowa State for the first time about, they didn't know who I was. They were just ecstatic. Wait, someone's coming here. We're going to do a live show? And they would roll out the red carpet. And then for years, when we tried to do the same thing at Iowa, it became a running gag. They found ways to jack with us. ISDN lines wouldn't get installed. Mm-hmm. 1 year, they called me 3 weeks after Media Day. Phil Hattie, the old Iowa SID, literally called me 3 weeks after Media Day to tell me, hey, your ISDN line came in. That is an absolutely true story. I used to bring John Miller from Hawkeye Nation over with me because I thought, all right, here's my ghetto pass.
Yeah.
They'll be fair to us. And I thought, now that I'm with, and when I went to work with KXNO, I thought, okay, now we're with WHO or we're the farm team of the Hawk Station. Even then, they were awful and brutal to work with. Iowa State would roll out the red carpet. And then I had an opportunity to own a scout.com website that covered Iowa State. And that gave me a chance to really get to know Coach Mack, his coaching staff, a lot of those people on on a personal level and get really close to the program. And little anecdotes you see when you're around the rivalry. I remember after Iowa State came back from that 24-7 halftime deficit in 2002,
yep,
which to this day is the most fun I've ever had covering an event. Sports or politics was that day. I've covered presidential campaigns now, a lot of other big-time stuff. The most fun I've ever had, though, was sitting in the old Kinnick press box, the back row with B.J. Chabon. And it's 24-7, and all the old Hawk hangers-on pretending to be reporters are chanting, standing to the fight song, it's a blowout. You've got Ed Podolak telling John Ault, I'll see you at the post-game celebration, right?
Yeah.
And of course, the way it used to work is, if you were the Iowa State media, you were in the back row, obstructed view seating with all, in the old Kinnick press box. You couldn't see a darn thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all running smack at us and mocking us. And then with every Brad Banks turnover,
yeah,
Tim Tebrink, with he was the Buddy Biancolana of that game. That was his one shining moment as an Iowa Stater. He played out of his mind in that third quarter of that game. And you know, Seneca Wallace being Seneca Wallace. And when they took the lead, man, and it's quiet as kept in that press box, and the only thing you can hear is me and B.J. Chabon and a couple of other people in the back row of the Iowa State media laughing. to the point I almost wet myself. We go out onto the field, and I'll never forget just watching guys like Jordan Karstens and Bob Montgomery. They were spent. They had given absolutely everything they had. I was the last one in the pink locker room that night with Jordan Karstens. He literally could not get up to walk out of that locker room from that comeback. And, you know, the guy who was famous for shooting the Easter eggs, Marty Fine, mm-hmm, the old Iowa State offensive line coach.
Set the program back 5 years.
He walks up to me as we're leaving the field that night, and he looks, puts his arm around me, goes, "Looks like we became the right. Looks like we picked the right year to become Cyclones, Dace." That's what he told me, and it was. And my lasting memory of that game is all the lights go out. I'm the last media guy leaving the locker room. There's one drunk Iowa State fan sitting in the end zone. And he's just up there by himself, like his buddies just left him there. He's so drunk they just left him there. He's the last guy left. They're turning all the lights off at Kinnick Stadium. The guy gets up to walk out. I'm watching him the whole time. The guy gets up to walk out. Then he takes one last look around the stadium, flips it the middle finger, and then he turns around and walks out. And I thought to myself, now that is a rivalry. And I've had a chance to experience a lot of fun things like that with this game. It was a blast, and we built a pretty successful radio program out of essentially picking a fight between Iowa and Iowa State year-round.
Now, the one memory I have when you talk about picking a fight was 2005, the 23-3 debacle. That was the year that you played all the sound-off,
yes,
replays on your show, right?
Yeah, and of course I didn't tell our management I was going to do that because I don't think they would have gone for it. So I'm kind of a beg for forgiveness, not ask for permission kind of guy. And I had let it leak to our old producer, Corey Kuhn, and a couple other people that, hey, especially because we had listened to the sound-off the week before. And you've got people calling in to Zobel and Miller, Iowa State's not even going to score. This is going to be a blowout. Iowa's ranked eighth in the country. Iowa State should have lost to Illinois State the week before,
yeah,
frankly.
They really should have lost.
And we recorded all these clips. We played them as an intro in our show all week long just to kind of stoke the fire a little bit. We had done a live College Game Day show for MediaCom that was a lot of fun. Remember, it was like 170 degrees that day there, too.
I do remember.
And I was about 100 pounds bigger then. So that was not the funnest day I've ever had. The most
Bryce
fun I've ever had.
Some weight on
I
that
did,
yeah.
And it was. I think they estimated like 80,000 people showed up for a stadium that only seats 55.
Yeah.
So
yep,
there was 25,000 people there with this year, just there to party, tailgate, enjoy the atmosphere. And I kept picking boldly and brashly that brazenly that Iowa State's going to win all week. I wasn't necessarily confident in that, you know. But when they finally laid the wood to them afterwards, and I had all those Iowa calls from the week before, and I remember in 2001, the year the game got moved back because of 9/11.
Yeah.
And Todd Stevens and I, the old Ames Tribune reporter, are riding back from that game, listening to the Hawk fan meltdown, firing Kirk Ferentz, the late, great Jim Zobel, who was a dear friend of me, was a great guy to me. Mm-hmm. He's so despondent. He's telling his co-host to go get him a drink. He can't handle it. And we're like, we've got to record this and play back the calls, because if they lose this one, when they're in the top 10 and Iowa State should have lost,
yeah,
to Illinois State, they're going to flat out have a meltdown. And sure enough, they did. And we didn't say anything. We just came in the next Tuesday. And I didn't want to do it Monday because I figured everybody would expect something's coming, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So we came in Monday. We did it. We totally played it straight, a post-game wrap-up. We just did straight analysis, didn't do any smack.
Yeah.
And then just when everybody thought, all right, game's over, let's move on with the rest of our lives, then I thought, now let's kick some salt or some sand in the eye. And so we came back the second day afterwards, replayed all these calls, just did a three-hour mystery science theater kind of feedback. And it's the most mad. I mean, even to this day, I will say stuff with presidential politics and people lose their minds.
Yeah.
I've never had people more mad at me than Hawk fans. I mean, they were posting on Hawkeye Nation a list of all of our advertisers to boycott.
Seen that before.
Yeah, they were losing it. And I remember one of them sent Van Harden, our program director, an email. He felt personally betrayed. This is our radio station, WHO, to allow Dace to sully it like this. I feel like you have personally betrayed me. And as soon as I read that email, I knew we had done exactly what we set out to do.
Yeah. Did you? What were the closed door meetings like after that one? Slap on the wrist.
It was. Great radio. Don't ever do that again.
I can believe that.
And so we never did that again.
I can believe that. I thought it was interesting earlier this week. Paul Rhodes was actually on with Keith and Andy on KXNO, and he was pretty much bluntly asked, "Is this Iowa State's Super Bowl?"
Mm-hmm.
Which, Lord knows, you've heard a lot of that talk over the years, as have I.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like some of the days that we're talking about right now, you probably could have made that.
This was legitimate.
It's how McCarney built the program.
It is, Chris. I was there. I was at those practices. I knew Keith Sims and Reggie Roby when they would come here together, and you know, they'd go over to the Gateway Hotel over there in Ames, for the night before the game, and I'd be over there playing Xbox with them, and I knew Dan coached that like it was a Super Bowl. It mm-hmm. was a season unto itself. Maybe a Super Bowl is not a good analogy. How about a bowl game? A separate season experience aside from the rest of the season. And he had to do that. Mac needed something to sell at Iowa State.
It was brilliant if you look back on it now.
Now I think your program has transcended that.
Yes,
now.
Exactly. Yeah. And Rhodes was just adamant about that. I mean, he said it was ridiculous, and he went off on a bit of a tangent. Not really a tangent, but you could tell that it was kind of like throwing salt in the wounds right there, even mentioning that to Paul Rhodes.
He should feel insulted by that. He took a lot of the, you know, Dan McCarney broke the sound barrier at Iowa State.
Mm-hmm.
There's been times that Paul Rhodes has almost gone the speed of light. He's taken strongholds Dan couldn't break down, winning at Nebraska, winning at Texas,
mm-hmm.
Beating a top five team when Oklahoma State was number two. He's taken things that Mac was that next step of the program Mac wasn't able to take. So Paul should feel a little should take it personally that hey, we've already conquered that ground. We've mm-hmm. already broken that ground. I don't have to go back and do that again. We already took that hill once.
9 of 15 is what they've won right now in the rivalry. I am so confused going into Saturday. Usually, because I mean, I cover Iowa State for 365 days out of the year. I feel like I know the roster, the depth chart about as well as you can know it. I have no clue what's going to happen, though, based off of what you saw against Northern Iowa, this utter debacle that was their play in the trenches against the FCS Northern Iowa Panthers. Pretty good mm-hmm. team, I think, but they're still the FCS Northern Iowa Panthers. And then I watch Iowa. I watch them against Northern Illinois, and I left that game going, they've got something to build on here. I thought that about the University of Iowa. I thought their quarterback played all right. He had the bad mistake at the end of the game. Obviously a pretty good offensive line. Weissman is Weissman. Something to build on. Love their linebackers. Watch the Missouri State game, and then the whole any good feeling you might have about the University of Iowa goes up in flames. Mm-hmm. You've got a young team with Paul Rhodes. Have no clue how they are going to respond. I think it's as 50-50 as I remember this game in quite some time. I thought last year was a lot like that, but I thought Iowa State had better personnel. I don't know this year. Well, what's your take on that?
It reminds me a lot of 2007 with both teams lacking an identity per se. Iowa had more identity, even though you had a young quarterback in Jake Christensen, who there was a lot of promise for at that
mm-hmm,
time,
mm-hmm.
and he never lived up to any of that promise. But Iowa still had the identity of 2004, their co-Big Ten champions. You know, 2005, they had been ranked in the top 10 until Iowa State beat them. 2003, they finished the year in the top 10. So there was at least some identity based on what the program had done leading up to that year. Here at Iowa State now, you've got the excitement of Gene Chizik coming in 2007, but he mm-hmm. hadn't built any kind of a program. And just to show you what happens when you have two teams that are in a similar place trying to find themselves playing early in the year in a key game, no one would have predicted the outcome of that game would be decided by, of all things, Iowa State and perfect place kicking.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what happened. Okay, and so I kind of sense that same thing. Iowa has some identity they can build on, and that identity is they know they can run Mark Weissman against almost anybody when they have to. They know they can do that. The problem Iowa has is the same problem they had last year. How they can build on that to take their offense to the next level. How they can, once they've established that now, how do we then build off of that so that we can threaten teams up and down the field? They haven't figured that out yet. And a lot of that, I think we're finding out, whether it's James Vandenberg or Jake Rudock, it's not necessarily the quarterback position. It's what they don't have at wide receiver. I think we're figuring that out. Now, for Iowa State, and we've learned in past years, whatever Iowa State does the week before the Iowa game almost doesn't matter. And it's not because it's still Iowa State's Super Bowl. It is, though, because it's a rivalry game. And if you follow any great rivalry in college football, Iowa-Iowa State, Navy-Army, Michigan-Ohio State, Alabama-Auburn, a lot of times it doesn't matter what happened the week before. Because if this is a statement game for your season, and you can radically transform the way your entire season is looked at on both sides by what happens in this game. Now, the thing I'm the most worried about for Iowa State, Chris, is I don't believe anything positive happened. I don't think there's anything at all coming out of that game that they can say, all right, let's build on that. I thought the young quarterback made some good decisions in the first half and got you in a position so that you weren't just ran off the field from what was really a middle school defensive effort in the first half.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then in the second half, though, I thought he's got to step up and make some plays. You've got to, when you get into those positions in the red zone, you're playing an FCS team, you got to score touchdowns there. And if you do, you win the football game. They weren't able to do it. So what concerns me from an Iowa State perspective is I don't know what they think. All right, when all's well, Iowa knows it's third and six. We're not sure what we can do. We know we can get at least 3 yards from Mark Weissman, punt, and maybe he'll break a tackle and get a first down. I don't know what Iowa State thinks it can do. In many respects, this is like another a reboot of the whole season for Iowa State, another first game, because you had a first game that was an unmitigated disaster. The best thing you can say about it is nobody died. And then you had a bye week.
Yeah.
And so now it's like we're starting the whole season all over again. Now, that can also be to your advantage because the Iowa coaches are going to be really guessing as well.
Exactly.
The Iowa coaches have to know that whatever film they saw against Northern Iowa, some of it, what you saw that was bad, some of that's a youth and talent issue. But you have to, if you're an Iowa coach, you also have to go in there assuming these guys have had 2 weeks to reinvent themselves. So I think there's an early schematic advantage for Iowa State if they can come out with some momentum. Similar with the Steel Jance game of a couple of years ago, where they can catch Iowa flat-footed a little bit. But I think if they don't start fast, I do think there is a more powerful physical advantage in the game for Iowa between the tackles.
Well, I would agree with that. And I'll tell you this from the Iowa State perspective. I hate tossing the words must win around in week three. I hate it. It's a pet peeve of mine, actually. But if they want to get to 6-6 this year, I think it's doable, but you have to win this game just based off of the Big 12 conference. The bye week last week allowed me to watch like six of the Big 12 games, you know, through from between then and now. There are five or six winnable games in the Big 12 this year for Iowa State, and I can tell you, as I came around covering the program around 2005, the overall talent level then compared to now is not even comparable.
I agree.
It is not even comparable. It's very young right now. I mean, always is when a coach comes into a program. They were at rock bottom when Paul Rhodes came to town. He got them to 6-6. He proved that he could win. But you really don't start recruiting and getting your guys in until years two or three. As far as the Quentin Bundridges of the world, you know, guys that you see out there right now. Now they're out there, but it's for the first time. But back to the point on the whole must-win thing, they went on Saturday. I legitimately think they can somehow crawl back to 6-6. But if you lose, you know, how does a young team react to that? And I think the wheels could potentially fall off as far as 2013 goes.
I completely agree. What you're talking about reminds me of 2003. And Iowa State had, I think they started 6-1, 7-1. They had the close loss to Florida State, a game a lot of people to this day think they should have won there at the end in Kansas City. Seneca Wallace is a Heisman front runner. He has the quintessential Heisman moment against Texas Tech. Then, of course, they have that debacle in Oklahoma the very next game. And they ran into the second half of that. That was maybe one of the best seasons the Big 12 has ever had, top to bottom, strength-wise.
Yeah.
But they lost a lot of players from that team. And the younger guys that were coming up, the Stevie Hickses, the Ellis Hobbs, the Brett Myers, the Todd Blights, they were better than the guys that had left. They weren't ready yet, though, to be better. And they were facing a Big 12 schedule very similar to the one they're facing this year, where it was just week after week after week after week. And they got Iowa at home early on. And they lost a game where even though they had outgained Iowa in that game, mm-hmm. I think substantially from what I recall, they had too many special teams breakdowns. A couple punts I think were blocked. Iowa wins the game. The next week, Iowa State had a bye, if my memory serves, and then they had to go play Northern Illinois on the road.
I remember that.
And they had Michael the Burner Turner. They had beaten Alabama and Maryland in the non-conference. There was talk about them going undefeated. And Iowa State had that game won in the fourth quarter. I think Hiawatha Rutland got hurt, and Northern Illinois found a way to pull it out at the
tore
end.
Tore his ACL, didn't he?
Yes. And after that game, after that season, I remember talking to a couple of the Iowa State players off the record who were getting ready to graduate. And one of the things they told me is, hey, we look at the magazines you guys look at too. We read all that stuff in June and July just like you do. And we're W and L in our scale, like we're W and L-ing our schedule somewhat like you do. We don't ever say we're going to lose that game.
Yeah.
But we'll look at each other and say, that one's going to be tough. That's the one we got to get, okay? And they told me, listen, we looked at that schedule in the fall, and we thought that's the swing game to the schedule. That if we win that Northern Illinois game, going into the Big 12 season, that gives us a lot of confidence. Similar to when McCartney finally broke the bowless streak in 2000. They had a great swing game after beating Iowa. They had to go on the road to Baylor. Game they ought to win. Remote outpost at the time, though. Friends and family plan. Flies show up. It's the kind of game where you can sleepwalk in Waco and they can ambush you. And if you want to take that next step, you got to win that game. They went down there, won that game comfortably, and that got them to that 4-0 start, and they were on their way at that point. I think this is a swing game for both of these teams. Both young, both trying to reinvent themselves, both trying to find their identity. And I just get the sense with Iowa State, the younger talent that's emerging is better than what we've seen. They're maybe not yet ready to be better. Mm-hmm. And they need a confidence builder. You know, they need something that says, all right, we've arrived, we're ready to play. And I think this game is that for them. And I think Iowa's entire program, Chris, is at a crossroads.
Yeah.
There's two narratives right now in Hawkeye Nation. One is, all right, you know, we're seeing the exact same stuff we saw last year. Nothing's changed. The other narrative is, actually, you know, we're putting up a lot more yards. We look much more effective on offense. We're playing an inexperienced quarterback. He gets more experience. We'll be more efficient, and those stats will turn into points, and those points will turn into wins. I can make a case for both of those narratives. I think we'll have a better idea about 8:30, 9 o'clock Central Time Saturday night, which of those two narratives it is. And so I think Iowa's season is at a crossroads. I think Iowa State's season is at a crossroads. Chris, I think Iowa's program is at a crossroads.
Yeah, and I'll go straight clone homer on you right now. When I look at Iowa, and the obvious concern for Iowa State is front seven on defense, how do you stop the run against a good offensive line, against a bulldozer of a running back, which you don't see in the Big 12 conference very often. And you touched on this just a little bit earlier, but to me, I'm thinking, why can't Iowa State just go single coverage with the corners on those wide receivers? You've got two big safeties who are not afraid to come up and hit somebody, completely stack the box. And I'm thinking, what can Iowa do that we haven't already seen? You know, what can they
do? Well, that's been the Iowa State game, defensive game plan. As John Miller at Hawkeye Nation likes to joke, they become the steel curtain 1 week out of the year.
Yeah.
And it's because it's the rest of the season you're going to play a lot of spread teams.
Yeah.
Teams that play 3-4 wide receiver sets, ace formations with two tight ends and one back. You can't get away with that. Okay, but Iowa's going to come in with their pro sets, their tight formations, and if they don't have the talent on the outside to exploit that, to create a big play. If they don't have that, then we've seen what you've just described has been the recipe for defensive success for Iowa State against Iowa for many years.
The difference, though, and this is what concerns me, when you have A.J. Klein and you have Jake Knott, Iowa State can play that Big Ten brand of football pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how Jared Brackens, Jeremiah George, and Luke Knott are going to do. You know, I mean, they're a lot smaller, they're not as physical, and they're inexperienced. So to me, you know, that's kind of thrown in a wild card into the entire scenario that we
Nick
just
Saban
analyzed.
Said years ago that if he had a choice between, as a defensive coordinator on the collegiate level, if he had a choice between game planning to take away a great wide receiver or game planning to take away a great tight end, he said he'd rather game plan to take away a great wide receiver. And the reason why, he said, because a lot of collegiate linebackers aren't good enough in space, and they can get eaten alive, even if they're really, if they're even athletic, instinctively against that kind of a game-changing tight end. You just mentioned, I think, a key thing. I think I think it's one of those subtle things, because it doesn't show up in the stat sheet unless you know how to watch a game and watch film, how good Iowa State was in keeping scores down in the Big 12 mm-hmm. because of how instinctive those two guys were in the passing game as linebackers. Even in Alabama doesn't necessarily get two guys like that that are that good at their drops, that good in zone coverage. You know, if you watch the Michigan-Notre Dame game on Saturday, what happened? Notre Dame won the line of scrimmage, their defensive line against Michigan's offensive line. So how is it they gave up 41 points and could have easily given up more? Well, that guy in the second level there, that man Iteo, takes that middle of the field zone away, so your quarterback's not going to get out of there for a 20-yard run, and he gets a deep enough drop that you can't throw over him on play action. That second level of the defense, the guy that can patrol that, is a huge loss for them. They can't replace that. And that's, I think, the biggest concern that fans have for Iowa State. Now, the problem that you have going up against Iowa is while their wide receivers are pedestrian, the one kind of downfield weapon I think they have that they don't use enough of is C.J. Fedorowicz.
Yeah.
A huge target. You know, he looks like Scott Chandler, doesn't run like a Tony Moiaki, mm-hmm. but when you're that big, you present a huge target down the field for your team, and I do think that is one of the key matchups in the game to watch, is Fedorowicz against Iowa State's linebackers in the passing game.
Could not agree more with that, and then more of the clone homer here. I think a lot of people are getting enamored with this Iowa rushing game, right? Rightfully so, and the way Iowa State's defensive front seven played against Northern Iowa. But at the same time, I mean, this is a program that's lost, what, 7 of 8? And
its win, that its slump buster, was arguably the worst team in the FCS. One of them, anyway.
That's saying something.
Yep.
So that to me, too, I mean, if you're looking for some positive here, because I think a lot of the doom and gloom has been spelled out, and rightfully so. If you watched Iowa State's front seven against Northern Iowa, it's easy to see how you would not be very optimistic heading into this thing. But I think that I almost feel like Iowa's running game has been credited a little bit too much heading into this game. I don't know. That's just my take. Am I accurate, or is that clone homer?
Iowa's running game is adequate. It would be much better if they were able to capitalize on it to keep defenses honest.
Yeah.
You're a Minnesota Vikings fan.
Correct.
All right, so you and I watch the same NFL game every single play on Sunday because mm-hmm. I'm a Detroit Lions fan. Now, how is it, if the idea last year that you would have held Calvin Johnson to 37 yards receiving and the Detroit Lions would put up 41 point, or 34 points and frankly should have put up over 50,
yeah.
Okay, would have been preposterous. Well, what changed? Well, all the attention you have to give Calvin Johnson leaves all this space underneath.
Yeah.
You know, the Lions were 5-0 when Javid Best was healthy. Since he went out with concussions, they went 9-19. Why? Because there's nobody that can exploit all this space underneath that a defense has to give up to stop a Calvin Johnson. Similar to, you know, how many yards does a Robert Smith get when you've got a double team Randy Moss on the other
exactly.
side?
Exactly. Yeah.
Right? How well does Percy Harvin do when you got to play 9 in the box against Adrian Peterson? Right. So now that the Lions have a Reggie Bush, someone can take advantage of all that open space and those advantages underneath because you have to pay attention to Calvin Johnson. Now, the Iowa program, you don't have to do that yet. You know, if they had just one playmaker on the outside, their running game would go from adequate, I think, to pretty good, because then you'd have to respect what else they have. So I don't know that I agree. I'd say their running game is overrated. I think that it's underutilized
mm-hmm.
because they don't have the weapons on the outside to make you play that running game straight up. I think all of the angst about Iowa State isn't just about losing to Northern Iowa. We've seen Iowa State lose to Northern Iowa and beat Iowa anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's, hey, we lost to Northern Iowa, but we know that Brett Meyer and Todd Blythe are pretty good.
Yeah.
It's that we lost to Northern Iowa, and we still don't know what we have. It's like the game itself was a complete and total waste of time. We didn't come out of that with anything that said, all right, going forward, we know we got that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where the angst for Iowa State is coming from.
It's going to be a doozy. 5 o'clock. Do you want to make a prediction, or are you waiting toward the end of the week?
No, okay. To me, it's typical of what we've seen in this rivalry, where you think Iowa should probably win.
Yeah.
But Iowa State probably will. I mean, it's kind of what we've seen over and over and over.
That's where I'm at.
Yeah. Iowa should win the game. And it's not because they're that much better than Iowa State. It's just because their team's a little bit more settled right now. Iowa should win the game. They probably won't. I think Iowa State will end up winning the game.
Yeah, I think I'm leaning that way. If you would have said a week ago, there's no way I would have gone that route. But after watching Iowa-Missouri State, and there's like a... I mean, they're borderline jovial around the Jacobson Athletic Building right now. I mean, I don't sense panic within Paul Rhodes, which leads us into Texas. I want to pick your brain on some other Big 12 schools. I just used the word panic. That I believe you used to use the phrase that was a detesticled game.
Yes.
How did you? Is that?
I've never seen that correctly? I have never seen anything like that. Over 500 yards rushing against a quarterback making his first real start. Yeah, he played against Virginia the previous week, but against a real team.
And he lost to Virginia.
He lost to Virginia. I think they lost 18-17.
Yeah.
He put up over 500 yards, rumbling, bumbling, stumbling down the sidelines with a knee brace on.
Yeah.
That was just turning your testicles. You have been demanhooded in a game like that. And what I think is interesting is there's a common denominator here. You know, Manny Diaz's last game before he went to Texas, I saw that game very closely because it was the Gator Bowl against Michigan.
Okay.
And he was the defensive coordinator for Mississippi State. And Denard Robinson housed them on the first drive. And then we didn't do anything the rest of the game. We got 50 points into that game. This game got Rich Rodriguez fired. So this guy just got dumb all of a sudden. You know, they've already made changes at offensive coordinator now. Now they're making changes at defensive coordinator. The guy they're bringing in, well, I know that guy really well too. Because he was Michigan's old defensive coordinator. And when Mack Brown was asked about Greg Robinson and the disaster, the hot mess that was his time at Michigan, he said, well, you know, they didn't have very good players. Okay. Well, the very next year, Greg Madison came in from the Baltimore Ravens with all of the exact same players. They didn't have some stud freshman came in, that transformed the defense. It was all the same players. They were top 20 nationally in total defense and went 11-2. So he was a disaster as the head coach at Syracuse. He was a disaster, drove that program into the ground. Next guy comes in, Doug Marrone, he wins enough to get himself an NFL coaching job.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I don't get how he comes from afar. He was a consultant, but he doesn't know the guys. And so he's going to come down from a tower, basically, and watch and film in the middle of a season. And he's going to come down and correct all of these errors. It just seems to me like the game has sort of passed him by. He's kind of gotten old really quick. And it's a shame because he's a class guy, and it's a great program. But there is never, ever, never, ever, ever. Never is a tough word in this day and age.
Correct.
But there is never an excuse ever for Brigham Young University, a private religious school, to rush for 300 yards against Texas, let alone then 500 yards. That should absolutely...
And change.
Yeah, they were closer to 600 than they were 400. That should never, ever happen, Chris. Ever.
Well, what troubled me when I was reading on Sunday that Diaz had gotten fired, I read some quotes from Mack Brown basically discussing how he was troubled by the fact that there weren't any adjustments made. And doesn't Mack have a headset?
Yeah.
Can't Mack say anything at that point? Shouldn't he be noting during the game that these adjustments aren't being made and actually do something about it? I just don't see a lot of accountability on his part.
He's sort of the last of the old CEO coaches. You know, Joe Paterno's gone now. Bobby Bowden became a CEO coach his last few years. We referenced earlier the game they played against Iowa State at Kansas City.
Yeah.
And that was the game where he broke Bear Bryant's record. And I spent about a quarter and a half of that game on their sidelines watching the dynamic of him as a coach. Didn't have a headset on. Wasn't into the game at all. Even on key fourth down situations, do we go for it or not? Wasn't making key decisions. And so if you're going to coach that way, if you're going to be the guy that says, all right, I'm kind of coasting now. I've got kids, grandkids. I don't want to put in these 90-hour weeks.
Yeah.
So I'm going to come in on the golf cart one day in January, so get a bunch of kids to recruit to us. Okay, if you want to do that, if you think you've earned your place, cool. But it means then you better be really diligent about who your assistant coaches are. And so Bowden decided to transition into this CEO right when he lost Mark Richt to Georgia, right when he lost Chuck Amato. Was outstanding defensive coordinator. Lost him to NC State as a head coach. Same thing happened to Hayden Fry at Iowa. You know, Chuck Long once told me greatest coach he ever played for was not Hayden Fry. It was Bill Snyder. Mm. Right? So, and that doesn't mean Hayden Fry is not a Hall of Fame coach. He is. But it's a little bit different when you've got the coaching staff with that coaching tree, that photo with Dan McCarney and Kirk Ferentz and Barry Alvarez and all those guys we've seen a million times.
Yeah.
Those guys are going to make you a better coach. Mm-hmm. Right? And so what I think is the concern here is when he does get rid of guys, he got rid of Greg Davis. Okay. He went a whole year and didn't work. You get fired as an assistant coach at Texas and you're not working? Mm-hmm. What does that tell you?
Yeah.
And then you got to go to Iowa, essentially, who's on their last legs on their offense. A huge thing happened in this program when they lost Will Muschamp. A lot of people aren't talking about that. They had set Will Muschamp aside to be his heir apparent. They even publicly proclaimed it. And about a year or so later, he left and went to Florida instead. And I think he sort of took the next era of Texas football with him.
So basically, it's with Texas, it's the same crap we've seen for the last 2 years, right? And you always hear this, well, there's so much talent. I mean, this is the year they're going to finally break out of it. Phil Steele even ranked them like fourth in the country.
19 starters coming back. You had a hard time looking at their schedule and finding a game that you knew they'd be an underdog in.
Correct. So my question to you, now that you watched the debacle over there in Provo, Ole Miss comes to town. Does Texas have a shot? Because I know some people are still holding on to it that way, you know, that somehow they're going to get this ship turned around. They still should win 5 or 6 games, you would think, in the Big 12 conference. But do they have a shot to even sniff a championship this year?
When you look at the rest of the league, and I think sometimes we make them, and I make this mistake too, we make the mistake of analyzing teams as a standalone product.
Yeah.
And, you know, we do this in the, I spend most of my time now in the political arena. And I think the mistake a lot of people make when they're analyzing campaigns is they analyze candidates as a standalone product. It's not an up or down vote on a candidate. You have to analyze candidates and how they relate to the rest of the field they're competing against, mm-hmm. right? And it's the same thing in here in sports. So as a standalone product, something is clearly wrong there. And you look at the players they don't recruit. They passed on Robert Griffin III, for example. They passed on Jameis Winston. We found that out a couple weeks ago at Florida mm-hmm. State. He wanted to go to Texas. They said no. It's the player development there that's going on too. So, but you also then have to analyze them in the context of the rest of their schedule and the teams they're playing. And what I see in the Big 12 is a league that lacks an elite team, has a lot of depth, a lot of teams that have 8 to 10 win talent, mm-hmm. but not a certifiable BCS championship team. So that gives them more of a margin for error than, say, if they were playing in the SEC. Mm-hmm. Or even this year, maybe the ACC, where I think the top of the ACC with Clemson and Florida State, Miami, I think, is a little overranked this week, but clearly they're back on the upswing. Mm-hmm. If they had those two teams on the schedule, then I think you'd say those are two definite losses. But you look at the rest of the Texas schedule, you tell me where you think you see a game they can't win, even in the shape they're in now. And I would say that about a lot of the teams in the Big 12,
yeah,
Chris.
Absolutely. And that's why, I mean, going back to our Iowa State conversation, that's why I think that this
that
week
is Paul
so
Roach's
critical.
Greatest accomplishment to me, Chris, yeah. is he retired my annual Rake Your Lawn Saturday. Yeah. There's no more games where you think as an Iowa State fan, there's no way we don't show up, we can't possibly compete, let alone win. You don't think that anymore.
That all disappeared after that Oklahoma State game.
It did.
Even the Nebraska game in 2009, I mean, Arnaud was out, Alexander Robinson was out, you had no clue who half the guys were even out there. They lost Taron Benton in the middle of that game.
That was
there's
the
guys
that,
puking in the locker room.
That
at
was
halftime.
That was, you know, if you look back at every successful coach, there's a game where they sort of cemented themselves, established their identity. That was that game for Paul Rhodes. That was his statement win as a head coach. And of course, the scene in the locker room afterwards that went viral and got played on college yeah. game day, that was that's what established his program at Iowa State, was that game against Nebraska.
Another game this weekend that I think that obviously has some interest for Iowa State, Tulsa goes to Oklahoma. Tulsa just an awful showing against Bowling Green in week one. They edged past Colorado State in week two. But I'm more interested in Oklahoma here, to be honest with you, because Knight, the freshman quarterback, looked pretty good, I thought, in the first half. He looked all right against West Virginia. He's down now. Blake Bell came in the back of that game. I don't think that – I mean, that's probably an 8 to 10 win team. But I think that is a team that we're going to look back on in January. I just don't see how Oklahoma's offense, in a weird way, kind of reminds me of Iowa in the sense that it just seems so one-dimensional at this point. I think it's pretty easy to game plan against them. Now, they still have Oklahoma talent, mm-hmm. but I mean, I like Tulsa to cover the 24.5 in that one.
I agree. You know, if it weren't for what USC did last year, going from preseason number 1 to 7-6, which I think was the worst record ever for a preseason number 1 team in the AP poll, Oklahoma a couple years ago, going from preseason number 1 to 9-3, and not even making a BCS game, would be one of the worst finishes for a preseason number 1 in recent memory. Mm-hmm. They've got one BCS win, I believe, since they won the national championship, and that was against what I think is the worst team to ever play in a BCS game, the Connecticut team they played that
yeah,
year.
Yeah, I forgot about them.
So I think you got, you know, Bobby Stoops got rid of some coaches this offseason. First time he's ever done that. They didn't go with the heir apparent at the quarterback position, Blake Bell. They went with Trevor Knight instead. Bobby seems to me like a coach who sees slippage in his program. And he's trying to make some dramatic moves to avoid having happened to him what's happening right now to Mac Brown. And I give him credit for that. It seems like he's trying to reinvent himself.
Yeah.
Trying to, you know, not get complacent, not rest on their past laurels. They seem to me, though, like a program that just seems to be there seems to be signs of slippage there, signs of deterioration. They brought back Mike Stoops thinking that would reinvent their defense last year. It didn't. They really weren't any better. And, in fact, the guy they got rid of went to Clemson. He had a better season.
Yeah.
You know, they won 11 games last year. So it just seems to me like they're a program that's also kind of searching and feeling around for who they want to be because they don't want to turn out like what's happening at Texas right now.
Of course, Tulsa's Iowa State's week three, well, it'll be like week five opponent. The schedule's all, it's got me all screwed up. Final game I wanted to touch on, TCU at Texas Tech. I found it interesting where not many people had TCU winning the league heading into the season. You and I both did. We were both enamored, I think, with their defense. Devontae Fields finally comes back. This is the Thursday night game, too, by the way, if you're listening. This is ESPN's Thursday night game, so I believe a 6:30 kick, TCU at Texas Tech. But now, you know, TCU's lost to LSU. Paul Hall is out for a few weeks because he broke his arm. I seem to think that this almost, for this week alone, may even play into their favor because I love Boykin. I think Boykin's a – I don't think he's that big of a drop-off from Paul Hall, and I think he is a little bit. But I think that he got enough experience last year where now that he knows it's my team for the time being – I actually, they're like a 3-point favorite, but I wouldn't be surprised if they win this game by 2 touchdowns. I know Lubbock is a nasty place to go in there. Players always tell me it's their least favorite place to play in the Big 12 just based off of the fan base. But I don't know. I just have a feeling TCU's going to run away with this one.
Smartest analyst, and for years I didn't want to admit this, but I have finally admitted it, and it's made me a more accurate predictor of games as a result of this humility. And the smartest analysts of all live in the desert, all right? And you can tell a lot about what they think. That's why people get mad at me sometimes for picking against the opening line, but I want to go head-to-head against them. When I pick against the line on Wednesday or Thursday, now I'm picking against the public.
Yeah.
Right? I want to go head-to-head against them. Not to mention, you know, you can get mad about picking against the opening spread, but if I bet a game on Tuesday and the spread changes on Friday, I'm still going by what was picked on Tuesday. So for me, I like the intellectual exercise of going head-to-head against the odds makers. When everything you just said is 100% accurate. But when you look at that spread,
I know.
That tells you they are begging you, outright begging you to take TCU. The only reason I took BYU as one of my lock picks last week is I looked at the spread and I thought there is no rational reason why Texas is only a 6-point favorite. Now, if Texas was a 13 or 14 point favorite, I'd have taken Texas.
Yeah.
The only possible reason that Texas is a 6 or 7 point favorite against a team that just lost to Virginia and looked bad doing it, by the way, and you're the big name school and you had just put up, you know, 50 some odd points and everybody says, now you're back. The only reason they would do it is they're begging you. They smell an ambush. They're begging you to take Texas. That's the only reason I took BYU, and it was one of the smartest picks I made last week. So this whole spread tells me TCU is walking into an ambush in Lubbock on Thursday.
Do you remember the West Virginia at Texas Tech game last year? The spread was, I think, West Virginia had been scoring like 80 points
a
game.
Yes, and Tech was favored.
Yeah, like 4 points.
And that's one of the reasons I kind of like Texas this weekend. One of my favorite bets in all of sports, favorite plays, is when an unranked team is at home and favored against a ranked team. All right, because understand the public's going to move that line. So when you see, every week I will always search for a ranked team at home against or an unranked team at home against a ranked team, and take that team every time. It's about a 75% proposition. And I love, you know, one of the picks I had last week is I took Illinois to beat Cincinnati. Everybody told me I was nuts. Only reason I did that is because I like it when the state school is an underdog at home to the directional or the city school. I remember a few years ago when Bobby Petrino first arrived at Arkansas, they were terrible. And they were playing Tulsa, who was going for an undefeated record at home late in the year. And Tulsa was favored. You do not tell a team in the Southeastern Conference that they are an underdog at home to Tulsa. I don't care what their record is, how bad they are. And Arkansas basically named the score against them that night.
Yeah.
You know, so this situation to me, short week, there's things I like about Boykin. I don't think he exploits the weapons they have as well as Paul Hall does. And it's an in-state rivalry game. A lot of energy and excitement about Cliff Kingsbury. You know, Cliff Kingsbury has going for him, Chris, what the mayor has going for him in your basketball program. And I remember when John and I were still doing our morning show, and when he got hired to be the basketball coach, and he kind of mocked it. He's never been a coach before. And I said, I guarantee he'll be successful. And John's like, well, you're just being a homer. I said, it has nothing to do with that. Here's why he'll be successful. Because everybody working there wants him to be as successful as he wants to be. Mm-hmm. Meaning, I'll give you an example. You know, if you're Wayne Morgan's secretary, and he wants you to call a recruit and make sure you set up that time to talk to his mom or go drive out there and visit him tomorrow, and it's the end of the night and you got to go, and your husband's text you and say, hey, our kids' school play and the basketball game, you got to get here. You know what you're going to say? For Wayne Morgan, you're going to say, hey, man, I got to go see my kid. I'll call the recruit in the morning. He might be gone in the morning.
Yeah.
But for Fred Hoiberg, you will text your husband back and say, hey, tell Timmy I'm going to miss the first quarter because we don't let Fred down.
Yeah.
So we're going to call that recruit's mom and to make sure he doesn't commit to that school he's visiting with tonight so Fred can get in there and talk to him in the morning. And see, when you've got a support structure around you that wants you to be as successful as you want you to be, you're going to be successful. That's what's happened with Pat Fitzgerald at Northwestern. It's what's happened with Fred Hoiberg at Iowa State. Same thing will happen with Cliff Kingsbury at Texas Tech.
Paul Rhodes to a point, too. I mean, you go to Iowa State. I've always compared this, and I had a conversation with Pat Knight about this a few years ago, too, when he was still coaching at Texas Tech. The Ames and Lubbock are eerily similar in a weird little way. I mean, you have to want to be there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? It's not a destination job for too many people. So, yeah, I mean, I get that. And I actually have written about that, comparing Rhodes and Kingsbury in their situation. But here's what concerns me, though, about Texas Tech. I mean, they've got this walk-on true freshman quarterback, right? And I see Gary Patterson called him said he had the it factor. But he's gone against SMU, be it was on the road. That was a good win, good season. That was a scary game for Texas Tech to go into SMU. And he's played Stephen F. Austin.
Especially when you're debuting a coach who could, frankly, date your girlfriend.
Correct.
Yeah.
You have no idea. He has no idea what he's about to get into with that TCU defense. And that's what makes me so confident. I mean, I see a defensive touchdown or two here. I don't know. I got to think. Going against your boys over in Vegas, man.
Well, listen, I would like to be right because I had TCU. I'm concerned they're going to slide now because I thought they'd win that game against LSU, who had the most losses to early entries to the NFL draft in history. So I thought they'd sneak up on him in that opening game especially with the more experienced quarterback, and it didn't develop that way. And I thought that would be a momentum kicker for them going into the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Now you look at all those road games TCU is playing now, and now you kind of look at them in reverse.
I had them winning in Stillwater, and I don't think I would probably do that.
I'll tell you, the
right
most
now.
Interesting team to watch the rest of the way, in my view, will not be Texas. Because I think we kind of know what's going to happen at Texas now. If they don't win at least 9 games, I think we know Mac's going to get kicked upstairs somewhere. They're going to bring somebody else in.
He gone.
I think the more interesting team to watch now that has the most to lose is Oklahoma State. Because of the series that's going on with Sports Illustrated, the specificity of the allegations. I know there was a story with Auburn last year or earlier this year, and it ended up getting debunked. But we're talking now dozens and dozens of players giving names, going on the record. Players that from the era that we've covered the Big 12, we would remember. Now, I hate saying this about Les Miles, a former Michigan Wolverine, but when I covered the Big 12 closely, you go to Big 12 media days, there were a lot of coaches that would tell you off the record, a lot of rumors about the stuff going on at Oklahoma State. They had the worst reputation in the Big 12 conference at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not surprised to hear about some of this, but what we haven't seen since in SMU, frankly, is we've heard of schools cheating on grades. We've heard of schools paying players. We've heard of sex at schools. What we haven't heard is, since SMU in the late 80s, what we haven't seen is one school do them all. And I think that's the concern I would have if I were Oklahoma State, is the distraction that may cause, what that does to your team. And, we've already got one instance of Mike Gundy having a meltdown over an off-the-field distraction. And I think this is that times 100.
Yeah, well, and it's impossible for the players not to be reading this stuff and not to –
Listen, you got NFL quarterbacks.
Yeah.
You've got NFL quarterbacks now. Brandon Whedon's insulated from all this with the Cleveland Browns. He's at their weekly press conference yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing a weekly press thing with the media at the Cleveland Browns practice facility. He's talking about it. He's in the NFL.
Yeah.
He's in a wholly different world now. So if Brandon Whedon can't get away from it, I don't know how the Oklahoma State players get away from it.
Dace, before we let you go, it would be just – flat out stupid not to ask you about Alabama, Texas A&M. Something tells me, I've known you long enough, something tells me you're not crazy about Johnny Manziel.
No, and I was a huge fan of his last year.
Yeah.
And, what really bothers me the most, I'm a guy that I believe you ought to be able to profit off of your own likeness. I'm a capitalist. I do not believe in paying players. I think we undervalue what an education costs. But I also think the merchandising and the marketing that, you've got a copy of NCAA Football 2014 on your desk. I've got one at home.
Yep.
Just playing it last night. The amount of likeness capitalization we are seeing in this day and age, it's unparalleled to what we've ever seen before. And so I do think now, when really the biggest money these schools make is a lot of cases not the TV rights, but the merchandising. It's not the attendance, it's the merchandising, it's the third-party vendoring.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if you're a grown adult, you ought to be able to profit off of your likeness. So, you know, and I know it's a rule, it's a stupid rule. He broke it, he probably should have been punished more than he was. I'm not bothered by the autograph stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what bothers me. What bothers me is your entire offseason, you're not with your teammates. And they're down there sweating their nards off in the Texas A&M heat, getting ready to come back, try to take the program to the next level. You're gallivanting all around the country more than Justin Bieber is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the part that I don't like is now I'm bigger than the program. The way you – and then instead of getting the message of your half suspension week one, you come out there again, make it all about you. That's the part that I don't like. I don't like the lack of leadership. He's now been set up to be bigger than the program. Frankly, the adults at Texas A&M have failed him.
Yeah.
There's not been enough structure, enough accountability. His teammates need to extract some inside, courthouse justice, if you will, within jailhouse justice, if you will, within the confines of the team, and rein him in. Because my fear is, you know, he's becoming the equivalent of a child star. It's like he's the Miley Cyrus of college football. A year ago, he was cute and adorable. Now he's twerking, okay? And now he annoys you. And I think someone, an adult there with some structure and some accountability, instead of enabling him, needs to step in and say, young man, understand, you've got the whole rest of your life to capitalize off of winning that Heisman Trophy. And you're about to make a 50-year mistake, man. A 50-year mistake, not mm-hmm. a 2013 mistake or even an NFL draft next year mistake. A 50-year mistake. The rest of your entire life, who you marry, what kind of kids you raise, your standard of living, what kind of lifestyle your kids grow up in and the men or women they eventually become, that's all going to be determined by some of the decisions you make for the next 12 months. You got to come correct, and it's my job to make that happen. So I think the system around him of enablers is failing him every bit as much as he's failing his teammates.
Well, the first thing I thought of when I was watching them play, it was that opening game against, Rice? I think they played Rice in their season opener, and I saw him antagonizing the Rice player, and the Rice guys probably started it.
Tim Tebow is everybody's angel who tiptoes through the raindrops. I watched him talk more smack than just about anybody else. The worst smack talker in the world. You know, and everybody let him go, frankly, because he was a white kid that didn't have tattoos, you know, like the Fab Five. Yeah. But the worst smack talker I've ever seen in college basketball was Christian Laettner.
Yeah.
He was the worst, most vile. Remember him stepping on Robert Timberlake in the Elite Eight? Okay, I mean, stepping on his chest. You know, when Dominican Sue does that, he gets a $100,000 fine.
Yeah.
Christian Laettner does that, it's a highlight on CBS. Okay,
yeah,
so
I'm
not bothered by that, but I'm bothered by making it about you.
The first thing I thought, though, was when I saw him react to the Rice players like he did, I thought, what is this guy going to do in Alabama? You know what I mean?
And Alabama may extract some of that justice this weekend. They may. In fact, I think they will roll them. I don't think there's a position on the field A&M has an advantage. I don't. And if you look at Nick Saban's, and I'm including quarterback, I'd rather have A.J. McCarron leading my program right now than Johnny Manziel.
Yeah, I buy that.
And if you look at Nick Saban's record in bye weeks, Nick Saban's record when he has more than 2 weeks to prepare. That's why he always schedules that huge non-conference game, first game of the year, because mm-hmm. he's got all year to prepare just for that game. You look at his record in revenge games. I think that this is going to be a woodshed beating on Saturday. Wow. I think they're going to send Texas A&M a message. And the message is someone needs to take that brat, put him over their knee, and break their foot off in his backside and realize, okay, now that we just got spanked, can we now be adults here and go out and play the rest of the season?
Line's like 7.5. You're all over Bama.
I would take Bama higher than that.
I agree.
Now, if the line was 3, I would take Texas A&M.
That really?
Yes, absolutely. Watch what they set for a line.
All right.
When they, you know,
learning something
yeah,
today.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that they're making Alabama more than a touchdown favorite on the road indicates that they're trying to entice you to take the other side there.
All right.
Now, what I might look at would be the number. I don't know what the total is. I'm going to look at the totals when I get home today. But I might look at the total in that game because I could see this being a game where Alabama's up 35-10.
Yeah.
And then we get some garbage time touchdowns at the end. You go over the total. I could see that too.
Dace, we're nearing an hour. I'm going to let you go, man.
All right. Sounds good.
I appreciate it. And I'm sure the Cyclone Nation does too. It's good. Good. The stories of the when the Cy-Hawk rivalry came to what it is today, I think people will really enjoy it. Thanks for coming out, all right, man?
You got it.
Steve Dace, you'll hear him out other weeks here on the Cyclone Fanatic Podcast. We appreciate him stopping by. Remember, we have our radio show tomorrow night, We will be at Benchwarmers in Ankeny from 7 to 8. I know a lot of people coming out to watch that TCU-Texas Tech game, too. So if you want to have a Paul Rhodes pizza, come on out to Benchwarmers in Ankeny. We'll be on 1460 KXNO from 7 to 8. Thanks for listening, everybody.